1320 WILS. I am Michael Cohen. Thanks for tuning in. With all the controversy about the role of the police in American communities, my next guest wanted to find out exactly what it's like. He, in fact, spent about a year following a homicide squad. Del Wilbur joins us, award-winning journalist, author of the brand new book, A Good Month for Murder, The Inside Story of a Homicide Squad. Del, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and what led you to want to write the book to begin with?
Well, you know, I really wanted to peel back, you know, you were talking about the national discussion we're having about policing and crime and issues like that, and I really wanted to peel back the veil on what it's like to do police work, especially like the most important work the police do, which is speak for the dead. And I wanted readers to be able to read a book that explained what the job takes and why it matters.
And how did, this is a squad out of Washington, D.C., how did you convince them to allow you to follow them?
Well, I got kind of lucky. The police chief in Prince George's County, Maryland, which is a suburb of D.C., it's just outside it. So it's like a setting both familiar and foreign to many readers. It's a suburb. You know, most of these crime books and shows are set in big cities. And he was a police chief, and his dad was a Secret Service agent who was in my first book. And my first book was Rawhide Down, the Near Assassination of Ronald Reagan. And it chronicled, you know, how Reagan was almost, you know, came within an inch of dying on March 30th, 81. And his dad was on Vice President Bush's detail, and he let me, I sent him my book. I said, I'd love to embed with your squad and see what they do, and he let me.
How big of a squad was this?
25 detectives, 5 supervisors, and they were hopping. And they're very busy in PG County, and I focused on one particular month, February 2013, where there were 12 murders and 3 police shootings, and they just ran from call to call to call. I mean, it was brutal. I fell asleep pumping gas. I fell asleep at a red light. Uh-huh. I mean, I was exhausted by the end of it. But when people are tested, I like it revealing character when people are pushed their limits, you know?
I see. So you'd follow whatever case was happening at the moment, you'd follow that story, you're saying?
I would, and I did a lot of reporting after because I obviously couldn't be everywhere. Mm-hmm. And then I had to make a really hard choice about what cases to focus on because, surprisingly, you would think 1 month would limit the amount you could write about something, but I was able to write like 85,000 words, and I actually wrote much more than that. I had to cut it back so that a reader could, you know, digest it. You know,
what's it like to be a homicide detective nowadays?
You know, it's one of the most challenging and cerebral jobs in law enforcement, and it requires doggedness, persistence, creativity, and a lot of luck. Mm-hmm. And it's just very difficult to solve murders when people just constantly lie to you and there's not a lot of evidence all the time. I mean, this is not, it's weird, art imitating life, life imitating art. This is very, very different than what you see on TV. But mm-hmm. there's some similar aspects that Hollywood clearly has borrowed, but very different.
What's the racial makeup of Prince George County?
Prince George's County is 65% black. Mm-hmm. It's a majority minority county, obviously majority black county. It's the wealthiest, one of the wealthiest majority black counties in the country. And it's a very diverse place, though. Like, it stretches everything from farmland all the way to, like, urban strip malls, like, depressed inner-city areas that, like, when you're driving on the border on Eastern Avenue between D.C. and P.G., the only way you can tell where you are is looking at the street sign to see if it has the telltale northeast or southeast tag on it for the district.
I see. Now, did you see any racial issues that these detectives were dealing with?
You know what's so interesting? I embedded with them in February 2013, and I think that we are having this national discussion that's actually really important for police work and how police should be diverse and forces should be diverse and how they should deal with the community. Mm-hmm. But my reporting was kind of before it, and that wasn't what I set out to do. I wanted to write a book about how do you, from their perspective, right? And the book's going to actually be an interesting Rorschach test, I think, for readers. They're going to look at it and go, some are going to think these cops are outlandish and go too far, and some are think they didn't go far enough, and some are going to think I should have done more on race, and other things I should have done less on race.
So not a lot of race discussions there in the book, you're saying?
No. To be honest with you, these cops just wanted to survive this brutal month and solve their murders.
The book is A Good Month for Murder. Author Del Wilbur is here. What motivates these guys and ladies to get out there and do this kind of work?
You know, I think a lot of it is just this internal drive, this alpha male internal drive to be really good at what they do. Mm-hmm. And they really want to speak for the dead. But they also, like, sometimes are motivated, like, I had a rookie, Eddie Flores, his first murder, right? He's on the scene of his first murder. It's a really hard one to solve. It's about a drug dealer who's been murdered who's not, like, the most sympathetic victim. I have a lot of sympathetic victims, but this is not one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But he still worked his butt off to solve it because he wanted to solve his first case. It was really important to him. And, you know, people bring their own motivations to these.
How hard is it for them? I mean, how much cooperation are they getting when they try to deal with these cases?
You know, I saw the gamut. It depends. Like, there was one scene in the book where this guy's knocking on doors outside a murder scene where a 15-year-old boy was shot to death for the shoes he was carrying to his girlfriend. And the detective's knocking on this door, and this woman answers and says, "Oh, yeah, I didn't see anything. I didn't hear anything. Okay, I might have heard something through my phone." "What? Through your phone?" "Yeah, I was on the phone. And this woman on the other end of the line said, I thought I just heard gunshots through your phone." I said, "Oh, I didn't hear that."
Mm-hmm.
She's clearly making up a story. She just doesn't want to be a witness, you know. And so she got all dissembled. I mean, who makes up that kind of story?
How frustrating is it for the police officers?
I think it's frustrating, but I think they're so immune to it now. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, they just don't. It, you know, they're hardened to it,
yeah.
So they just accept it as a fact of life.
What about the trauma of seeing dead people, dealing with murder and death all the time? How does that seem to affect them?
Well, it affected me, and I know it affects them, in that they build up a lot of defense mechanisms, so there's a lot of grim, funny, these are some of the funniest people I've ever been around, mm-hmm. gallows humor, and, you know, and they're all kind of, in their own way, outlandish characters. I have a diet pill popping cheeseburger eater, a chain-smoking vegan, the female quarterback of a semi-pro football team, and a dude who bragged about the herbal erection enhancers he was taking.
Hmm.
And those are the investigators. And I think that to do this kind of work and be in this environment where you're not only confronted with the worst 10% of the worst 10% every day of people, you're also seeing what you just mentioned, like death.
Yeah.
I think you have to have this, you know, you're a little nutty, I think.
How did it affect you personally?
It was very difficult. And, you know, I saw more than 25 corpses in my time. I slipped on brain matter. I ruined a pair of boots in a puddle of blood. It was very difficult. But honestly, the hardest thing, which is just bizarre and I still think about it, was that I had to watch, to do this book, I had to watch this security video of a murder over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept, by the end, I'm watching this video. You know how you watch a horror movie and you're like, "Don't open the door, don't open the door," but you know they're going to open the door anyway and get hacked to death? That's what I was telling this guy, "Don't run, get out of the way," and he gets shot and killed. And it's like, it's very hard to process that. It's like reality, but not reality. And I saw his body at the scene, and it was all very much.
After reading this book, do you think a person would have more sympathy than for what police officers are going through?
You know, I think that I think they'll have a better appreciation for what the job takes and why it matters. And you know, I was lucky as a journalist and author to be able to choose what I was writing about. So, you know, I made, you know, the characters I chose were ones who were, you know, among the harder working, the detectives. And I think that people will come, I think people will come to see that they were dedicated and they worked hard and, some were very creative and others were very dogged. And
what's the burnout rate on a job like this?
You know, they usually last 3 or 4 years, I think on average.
And then they just can't stand this type of work or?
I think then they want to be promoted, so when they retire, they have more money. But others just can't. You know, they get, like, some are addicted to the chase. Like, there's a Ben Brown character in there who did, like, for 10 years. But he couldn't do it anymore. You know, it was just too much. And then there's another detective who lasted literally a year. And he just, he had one really bad case, and he just couldn't do it anymore. And he had to do something else.
So when they deal with a murder, what's the percentage of likelihood of them actually finding the killer, typically?
Well, in February of 2013, they solved 10 of the 12 murders. And so in some years they do really well.
Mm-hmm.
In other years they don't. And I think that the numbers, even when you get up to 150 murders, you know, their clearance rate is better than average, which I think is about 50% or 60%.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they did better than that. And I didn't see any junk closures when I was there. Like the cases they made were as good as they could make them. And it was also illuminating to me. You know how, like, you see CSI and SVU and they wrap everything up really quick or whatever. And when you're there, you can see, like, or when you're covering a trial, you'd be like, "Oh man, why did the cops do that dumb thing? Why didn't they collect that evidence? Why didn't they take that picture?"
Mm-hmm.
But when you're with them, you understand how chaotic everything is and how hard it is to remember to do everything and how all the stuff is swirling around them, and you get the sense that now you understand where those mistakes come from. They're very human mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Were most of these murders that you saw, were they drug and gang related or?
No, you know, I had the panoply of motives. I had, you know, a random murder of a 17-year-old honor student that may or may not be tied to the rape of her foster sister. I had a robbery for shoes, a robbery of a television. I had a couple drug dealers killed, some MS-13 gang stuff.
Well, the random murder, was that solved?
No, and it's the arc of the book. And at the beginning of the book, the very first day, they interrogate the guy they think killed this innocent 17-year-old honor student, and they spent all month building the case against that guy. And then, like, the last part of the month, they learn it probably is not him, it can't be him. And then they get a DNA hit that leads them to the guy they think probably did it. And they interrogate him for 12 hours, but I don't want to reveal what happened.
I see. How good are they about acknowledging that, hey, we've got the wrong guy here?
You know what's really interesting? They're, from what I saw, they didn't have any wrong guys when I was there, but there was a moment where a detective pressed this one witness utterly to his limit. The guy was, like, sobbing, and he would have confessed to anything. And the detective came out of the interrogation room as this guy sobbing inside, closes the door, and turns to one of his colleagues and said, do you have any murders you need solved? I can get this guy to confess to him. And he was just joking. You know, he didn't mean it. And the detective laughed, whatever, and he's like, man, this poor sap, and he walked away. You know, he left that. Like, he had a chance where he could have pinned a crime on somebody, but he wanted the right guy.
And what did you think about seeing that dynamic?
I found it fascinating. Uh-huh. You know, it was both revealing of their intensity, because they really twirled this guy up, this witness, into this mess of sobbing.
You think they can do that to any of us?
No. I think that a lot of it depends on who you are and what you did. Like, there's this funny thing called the felony nap. Have you ever heard of the felony nap?
No.
All right, so, like, when they go, they put up suspect in the box, which is this 15 by 15 gray room where they're going to interrogate you, and they close the door. They'll look through the people, and if, like, you're sprawled out taking a nap, you're probably guilty. But if you're like, pacing around and you pissed your pants and you're sobbing for your mother, you're probably innocent.
That's interesting. So if you're guilty, you're actually more relaxed?
Yeah, I think it's because you're so used to it and some psychological thing triggers in your head and you just pretend either sleeping or this one detective said it really interesting. He's like, you know, these guys are reptiles, man. They have no feelings or emotions. They're cold-blooded. They don't care about the life they took, the one they're about to lose, you know.
That's an incredible dynamic. That's probably one of the more challenging places for them to be then in the interrogation room, it sounds like.
Yeah, you know, and the job itself is just super intense, especially, like, if you're thinking about, like, what people are going through in Chicago, what that homicide squad's going through right now. I mean, I saw it, like, during this pressed month. I mean, it was insane. Like, I was in an interrogation room with a detective and a witness, and the detective fell asleep mid-sentence. Literally, fell asleep mid-sentence.
Incredible, incredible. It's Del Wilber, author of the new book, A Good Month for Murder, The Inside Story of a Homicide Squad. Just out, the book again, A Good Month for Murder, Del Wilber. Del, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. I really enjoyed the time.